Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Still morning. Good morning, everybody. Before you all get comfortable, we're going to make you all stand up because it's silly having you all spreading out over there. So if you can stand up, I think Helen's just about okay on that table there, but if you can all move to these tables this side of the floor, that would be great, because that will hopefully lead to a much better discussion. And while you're doing that, just to introduce this session. This session is called Service and Commissioning Models. My name's Duncan Shrobsaw. I'm Director of Policy and External Affairs at Crisis. Crisis runs services but does lots of research and campaigning, and health is a theme which is always there. Excellent, you all responded to moving. This is brilliant. For me, I think this is potentially one of the most important sessions of the conference, because we all know we want accessible, comprehensive care that provides an integrated care, continuity of service, much better response to those who have the worst healthcare and life outcomes. But the $64,000 question, or the $1 million Murray question, is how do we commission those services from all of you out there? But you know, we'll all know that you know of great practices, particularly in primary care or services in secondary care, things like Luther Street, which you heard about before. The challenge is that where they've happened often by a lot of hard work and persistence and banging on the door by the healthcare professionals and those working with them, that to commission them and get them delivered, often in spite of commissioning arrangements rather than because of them. And what's happened is that they've all often grown up individually and had to keep justifying and fighting for their existence every 2 years to explain why their unit cost is a bit higher and why they do what they do and how they should are actually value for money and how they should continue. So we've had that as the background. We've now got the NHS reorganisation, a huge budget squeeze in the NHS and all related services, supporting people, mental health and everything else. So the core question is, how can we deliver the services we need for homeless people and get them commissioned? And hopefully, to help us in that debate, we're going to hear from two different models from two different parts of the country. On my left, we've got Bradford, and on my right, we've got Norfolk. So we're going to kick off with Bradford and Les and Gina from Bevan Healthcare, and their approach is around a community interest company. And we're going to do the presentations from here. We're going to have about 15 minutes of presentation, then go to Norfolk, and then open it up to you for discussion. Thank you.
Right. Good morning, everybody. I must say how humbling coming to this conference has been, hearing the kind of wonderful services that have been developed by our colleagues all over the country and across the world. We've come with our little story from Bradford. My name's Les Goldman. I'm a GP, semi-retired, although sometimes I don't really believe that. And I've got with me Gina Rowlands, who was our practice nurse and is now our managing director. So what we're going to talk about is how we got from 1986, when I started doing homeless surgeries at a drop-in centre in the centre of Bradford, to where we are today with Bevan Healthcare Community Interest Company. I'll see if this works. So this is my long and winding road, and that's what it's been. I'm just going to the next slide. So as I said, a quick overview of how we got to where we are. I think it's a slightly similar story to Luther Street. In 1986, I began doing twice weekly GP surgeries at a drop-in centre for homeless people in central Bradford called Bradford Day Shelter. By 1988, I'd managed to establish around me a small homeless health team. This consisted of a nurse who worked as a kind of practice nurse, a health visitor who was looking into the problems of homeless families in Bradford, and a community psychiatric nurse. This homeless health team continued in various guises. It was cut at one point, and then the Bradford Health Authority found some money to re-establish it. It went through two or three incarnations between 88 and 99. The service plodded along, doing outreach in hostels, doing my work at the day shelter continued. And if we fast forward to 1999, when the influx of asylum seekers began in Bradford, it was particularly started with the Kosovan refugees during the war in Kosovo and then continued. And a very small asylum health team was established, just one part-time health visitor and a part-time health visitor assistant. Around 2000, there was quite a lot of money around for PMS bids, and I think many of the practices that have been established around the country managed to tap into this money. And in Bradford, we began to discuss at PCT level the idea of a PMS practice. Initially, the PCTs or the PCG's idea, I can't remember whether it was a PCT or a PCG at that time, their idea was to start a practice for asylum seekers. And we tried to join on the healthcare of homeless people so that we began to develop plans for a practice that would look at with a wider remit for some marginalised groups in Bradford, but particularly thinking about homeless people, asylum seekers and refugees. And eventually, by 2003, we managed to open a surgery. We opened Bevan House Primary Care Centre in October 2003, as a third wave PMS practice, which at that time was managed by the PCT. So that's key. So we had, the staff, when we sat there, on the first day, we had no registered patients. I sat in the doctor's room and Gina sat in the nurse's room, and we waited for for person number one to come through the door. My five-year theory, I've got a five-year theory for organisations. You really need about 5 years to get them to sort themselves out. And by, I think, around 2008, we had a stable team of sessional doctors, nurses, admin staff, management, with continuing higher-level management from PCT. By 2008, we had about 1,500 registered patients. So if we fast forward to where we are now, it's September 2010, it became obvious that the future for PCTs was time limited, and we were worried about what the future of our service was going to be. Various options were available. We did worry that we were going to be put out to tender, and that we might be, or there was a chance that we might be, quote, bought, unquote, by a local practice. And we started talking to one of our more favoured options about this possibility. But then they backed out when the PCT was going to kind of put us out to tender as a job lot with another practice, which they didn't want to tender for. And so we started thinking about whether the social enterprise option might be right for our service. In September 2010, we hastily put together an expression of interest in becoming a social enterprise. This is through the NHS Right to Request programme. The PCT agreed to our initial expression of interest, and we then obtained a grant from the Social Enterprise Investment Fund to progress this expression of interest into a full business case. Now, this was quite a long and drawn out and difficult procedure. It took a lot of work, and I would say that the work for us as practitioners trying to keep a service going, also trying to keep our, you know, those of us who had other jobs, I was a full-time partner in a regular general practice, trying to keep those jobs going, trying to do this, produce this sort of 150, 200-page document, to submit to the PCT was a real difficulty, but we got there with the help of this grant and management consultants, etc. In January 2011, our business case was approved by the PCT, so it was the green light to set up as a social enterprise. By the 31st of August 2011, we had signed a five-year contract with our PCT to provide basically the same service as we were providing before. This saga was between the January and the August was a very difficult time, particularly the contract negotiations to establish what our budget was. Our budget was kind of hidden within this huge bureaucratic organization called the PCT. They didn't really know how much we cost, but we needed to know how much we cost in order to have a business, and that was a very difficult phase. We were again helped by our employed management consultants to get there, and the PCT's angle was always, you can have what you cost, but no more. So they start. That was their mantra the whole way through our contract negotiations, and it was really difficult to get them to understand that we needed to have at least slightly more than what we cost in case anything went wrong or there were sort of unexpected costs, because we were going to be launched as a completely independent business. Anyway, Gina signed the contract in the car park of a local hotel at about 8 o'clock in the evening, I think it was. Was it?
Sounds really dodgy, but it was legal.
Yeah. On the 31st of August, and on the 1st of September 2011, we went live as Bevan Healthcare Community Interest Company. So many things have remained stable and constant. Our staff transferred over under this thing called TUPE. Because we are a community interest company limited by shares, and our shareholders are NHS professionals who are employed by who work for our organisation, we continue to be able to be an NHS pensions provider. We felt this was important to continue. It was important to continue to be an NHS pensions provider because it would help us to attract and retain staff. But there is a risk that increased cost. But in order to do that, that is the only form of social enterprise that I'm aware of that currently allows you to be an NHS pensions provider. It's a quirk of the NHS pensions scheme. Our patients are very much the same. Their problems are the same. We're still in the same rather cramped premises. We still work with the partners that we worked with before, but we're gradually developing new and exciting partnerships, including potential partnership work with London Pathway, which is very exciting. Our values are the same. Our mantra is health. Well, our motto is health, hope, humanity. And the thing that is really exciting for me about this social enterprise model is that we're there for community benefit and not private profit. And I think it's very exciting, I feel, to be a general practice, but not a standard general practice partnership where it's the partners who take the profits home as their salary. If we make a surplus or profit as a social enterprise, it's absolutely clear what we have to do with that. It has to be reinvested in the community whom we serve. I'll just refer to Aniran Bevan, one of the founding fathers of or the founding father of the NHS. And we've always used this quote on our leaflet, and this is why we called ourselves initially Bevan House Primary Care Centre and now Bevan Healthcare. In February 1948, he said to Parliament, "We should take pride in the fact that despite our financial and economic uncertainties, we are still able to do the most civilised thing in the world, put the welfare of the sick in front of every other consideration." It's fascinating how true that rings, even, 55 years on. So there's been changes. Let's say we're no longer managed by the PCT. We're now a community interest company. We have this APMS contract with our PCT. This, we feel, has given, it's certainly cleared up what the purpose of our organisation is from the point of view. We always knew what it was, but at least our commissioners now know what our purpose is. We have also cleared up how much we cost. And this, for any of you thinking of spinning out from the NHS, this really was a nightmare. We do have to report regularly. We have to report to the Community Interest Company regulator. We've changed the whole way we're managed is completely different. We've got a core management group, which is the managing director, our practice business manager, medical director. We have a board of directors. Instead of being run as a partnership like a normal general practice, we're run by a board of directors who brought in skills from the world of business, commissioning, and so on. We can talk more about that later. We have shareholders who, many of whom sit on the board, but there are some of the health workers who work for us are also shareholders. And our roles have changed. So instead of me being a GP, I'm now chairman of the board. I'm also now medical director, which is slightly weird and can't go on, but I am. Gina is practice nurse, but she's also our managing director. So it's been a very interesting period. Gina's just going to tell us a bit about advantages, disadvantages. Are we all right for time?
Sorry. The main advantage of becoming a social enterprise for us and spinning out of the NHS is that we have complete independence and autonomy, which we never had before being managed by the PCT. We had a series of managers that absolutely didn't understand what we did and why we did it. It was incredible, really. We're much more responsive, flexible. We've got a lot more flexibility now, not just in terms of delivering patient care, but able for all the staff. It's a very equitable service that we run for the staff as well, for anybody to have an idea and give them that opportunity to run with it. And if it works, great. And if it doesn't, we learn by it and move on. By having a board of directors with non-executives on it, they've brought new skills to us and to the business. We were all clinicians before. We weren't business people, so we've had to learn quickly and on our feet. We have board members one particular board member is a very senior member of direction of PCT, so he's brought his skills from there. But we have somebody who's the managing director of a paint dispersants company, but has worked in a worldwide level, and that has brought us great skills and really good advice. And there's involvement. As I said, the staff are all involved. Everybody has an equal voice. We have a lot of talking. There's an awful lot of talking goes on. We have new partners that we work with across the city. And because we've taken this huge step and we have proved it's worked, we've become very attractive. Everybody wants to be our mate now and work with us. And we've unsurprisingly, and this was surprising to us, Les, wasn't it? We've made homelessness and the work we do with asylum seekers and refugees quite sexy and attractive. Everybody wants to jump on the bandwagon now, and it is attracting new funders for us. We've got new stakeholders, and the service users have a much bigger voice now. There's a service patient participation group, but it's much wider than that. And we're looking to have a members board where the service users and the patients will be part of that board. The ethos and the values of social enterprise suit this type of work because the social enterprise community, as it's turned out, is a very supportive community as well. And it is a bit like a group of dissidents raging against the machine sometimes and working for the social good. And we've got new sources of help, finance and advice from all sorts of people. Other businesses, other social investors who run big businesses are quite keen to give us advice and maybe a little bit of money as well. Free of charge, that advice as well, when we have asked for business advice or help or direction where to go. Yeah. The challenges for all of us are the changing NHS landscape. As we all know, it changes constantly, doesn't it? You know, we've gone from boards to PCTs and now to the CCGs. And our APMS contract ends in 2016, that is a challenge to us and it's a worry to us, and that is something we'll now come under the National Commissioning Board as from the 1st of April, and that's something that we'll work really hard with. We need to build up those links with the National Commissioning Board. We don't want cost to be the driver for it. We want it to be quality and the quality and delivery and the outcomes, the social impact that we're making as well. We must make our finances work, and we're doing really well. we're doing really well with the finances. We're improving our services. We've become a good employer. We have very little staff turnover. Staff stay with us. And we're in the position now where people are saying to us, do you have any jobs? If you do, can I come? Would you be interested? Can I come and do some voluntary work with you? The business is growing. We've attracted new contracts. One of them's through the UK Borders Agency with the Gateway Protection Programme. And we've proved that we're effective. We're very effective. And so far, we've got improved systems. Organisational review is going well. Our contract monitoring is going really well with the PCT. Well, what was the PCT? We're hitting all our targets. We've got our very specific KPIs, key performance indicators, and a QOF. We developed 3-4 years ago a local QOF because the national framework for quality outcomes was for mainstream general practice and didn't fit with our type of work. We weren't being rewarded for the type of work we were doing financially. We developed our own, and that's gone from strength to strength. And we've become a member of the Bradford City CCG. Bradford City CCG is one of the poorest, most deprived areas in the country. So us being part of that fits in with it. And we've made friends with the CCG. Andy Leppard, one of our GPs, is the representative on that body, as well as Lisa, who's our business manager as well. And they've come to visit us, see what we do. We've spent time with them. So we're building up those relationships again. The patient numbers are growing. We've over 2,000 patients now. But unfortunately, our patient numbers grow through the economic crisis that has happened, and the deprivation that was already in Bradford is increasing. So we're seeing more and more homeless people now, and we're seeing a new homeless population. We've always registered women and children, but now we're seeing middle-aged couples who have said, we've worked all our lives, the housing benefits have been cut, they've lost the jobs, they've lost the homes, and now they're in bed and breakfast accommodation. And we're seeing a new homeless population for us, for destitute asylum seekers as well. We've developed new services, and we've developed services, a late night clinic. They talk about in general practice extended hours. Well, we've started doing every Tuesday night, 8:30 at night till 11:30. The geographical area where Bevan House is where the women are working on the streets, sex working. Those women weren't accessing services, and 3 years ago, three women, street sex workers, were viciously murdered. They were all registered with us and were all picked up in our area. In the report that followed from the police, criminal justice, health, those women had not regularly accessed services. So with the Working Women's Project in Bradford, who do street outreach, we now open, and the women, they're bringing the women in. It's been really successful. And from starting off with a minuscule amount of money to do it, £2,000, something ridiculous that we managed to get, we have been commissioned. We found that out a couple of weeks ago, so we can take that forward and expand it. And the most exciting bit is we're in a rabbit hutch, really, at the moment. It's tidy with all our partners, but we're looking to move to new premises. We have a business plan in with the Social Enterprise Investment Fund, which is joint between the Department of Health and the Cabinet Office, to look for a grant loan business loan for us to move forward. So, as we say now, are we here or are we here? We have days where we feel on top of the world, and then, God, we have days where we think, why the hell are we doing this? But it is working out, and we are doing well. And the best thing is that we haven't ever, ever said no. We continually to keep moving forward, and the service users love the service.
Right. Thank you very much. Great use of pictures as well. I want to go straight to Norfolk and to Heidi and Kevin about what you do with City Reach Health Services in Norfolk.
Oh, sorry. Hello there. As you can probably guess, I'm Kevin, and this is Heidi. I'm just here to talk briefly about City Reach Health Services. It's been, as Les said earlier, it's been very inspiring to hear about other services across the country and internationally providing very similar services to what we provide in Norfolk, and it's been very reassuring to think that we're doing very similar to work to other areas across the country. But the message that we keep finding is how we're commissioned is very different and how we're set up. And I think these are the questions that we're hoping to raise today that we can feed back afterwards about how we can try and get a more uniformed approach to service provision for the healthcare of the homeless across the country. As I said, we're all working towards this. I know that Steve Field spoke about this yesterday, about eliminating discrimination and reducing inequalities in healthcare, and this is the goal that we should all be working towards sort of now and in the future. But I think before we look at the future, we need to look at the past and where we've come from. And it'd be interesting to look at our comparison at CityReach, how we compare to Bevan and also Luther Street and other services across the country. I think Heidi has been with the service from the start, so I've only been there 5 years, but Heidi's been there from the start, so it's probably a best person to talk about sort of where we've come from.
Our service started about 10, 12 years ago, and initially we were just commissioned as a project for 2 years. The story was that in Norwich, there wasn't really a homeless service at all. There was just a volunteer GEP who looked after a homeless shelter, which was just a church where people could turn up in the evenings, and in the morning they could pick up a diazepam prescription next door from a local GEP. When he retired, it was identified there is no GEP service for people who are homeless or haven't got an address. And the key factor was probably there were a couple of Norwich managers, and practice managers actually, and a couple of GPs who were just committed to establish a service or to develop something for people who are in great need. And those managers just identified a couple of GPs and made links with the local PCT and found people who would promote that project, that pilot. And we ran it for a couple of years and it was extremely successful. Initially it was going out to the new homeless hostel for doctors doing I did a surgery in a Salvation Army drop-in center where we just saw patients in a little cupboard room, we called it, with our doctor's bag. We saw them on the streets. We went to the YMCA, and we just saw them where they were. And we realized we couldn't reach them anywhere else, but that's how we established basically a patient population and our patient group. In 2002, there was a big meeting and it was decided there's definitely a need in Norwich for our service. So it was decided that we had permanent funding and we became a PMS practice. But how it was defined as primary care health services, so we did not do any methadone prescribing, for instance, and it was defined as a bridge service in a way. So we haven't ever registered patients on a permanent basis. So it was always thought that we see them for a limited time, and the aim is to redirect them into mainstream services. When all the changes came in 2008, we were commissioned by NHS Norfolk again, and the provider was identified as Norfolk Community Health and Care NHS Trust, so they are now our management service, basically, and we are employed by Norfolk Community Health and Care. They oversee different community services. That's where we are at the moment.
Did you want me to talk about the short term?
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's quite interesting looking at Bevan Healthcare, and I think it's where our stories up to 2008 were probably very similar, and it's from 2008 where things look to change. And as Heidi said, we went down the route of staying within one of the local NHS trusts, so we're still employed by Norfolk Community Health and Care NHS Trust, and that's our journey so far. From a short-term future, and I think this is the key thing, whoever's commissioning your service is about building those relationships with the commissioners, but the key thing is which commissioners do you need to be building relationships with. From our own point of view, there's lots of talk we've been involved with. We're based in Norwich, but our commissioners have been Norwich PCT, but then it moved to NHS Norfolk, and we are a Norwich-based service, but NHS Norfolk provides services for the whole of Norfolk. So more recently, we've been involved with dialogue with the local CCGs and with public health, and actually been proactively involved about in writing our own service specification, looking at KPIs are relevant for our service. As Heidi said, we're not a GMS practice. We would fail miserably if we were looking at the QOF targets that are imposed on mainstream surgeries. So it's important that we have KPIs that are realistic for our service and for our service users. As things stand at the moment, we remain within Norfolk Community Health and Care NHS Trust, and the CCGs have agreed to carry on our funding on a short-term basis, seeing us as a specialist service rather than a primary healthcare service. I think this leaflet here just summarises the work that we do, which is, I suppose, it's important looking in the context we're working within. Very similar to Bevan, that we work with people who are homeless, the asylum seekers, the refugees, gypsies and traveller services across Norwich and Greater Norwich. We also were involved with the Gateway Protection Programme from a different commissioning route, but that came to an end a couple of years ago, and I think the majority of people resettled further north in the UK. Have you got the next slide? Again, looking at the context of the people we see, as Heidi pointed out, we do not register patients, and we're commissioned to work with people on a short-term basis. At the moment, it's between 6 and 12 months is the commissioner's aim for us to get people back into mainstream, and we're constantly having this battle that for some people that's too short, and for some people they need to be accessing specialist services for a longer time scale. But if you're looking at the prevalence of people coming through, it's very similar to the other services we've been hearing from over the last couple of days. Can we just have a... Again, it's embedding that health message across other services, and I think that's where we've been very instrumental as a specialist service within Norwich. This is a leaflet we recently did with all other services within Norwich. It was led by ourselves and St Martin's Housing Trust, who the homeless lead for Norwich. And again, we've put this on here because the other change that we've had since we set up, historically we were an outreach service, and almost like a homeless service without our own base. But we now have a building that's managed by St Martin's Housing Trust. It's called Under One Roof, where it's about getting all services for this marginalised group within one building. I think that's been a pivotal moment in our service delivery.
And may I just add, it's quite important to be a health service from my point of view for our patients, because I think health is a good way in engaging them, and that's what they are lacking for. But on the other hand, it's all about linking them in with other services, and our building, where we are based in the centre of Norwich, linked to St Martin's, to a drop-in centre where they can have access to computers, access to group work, access to other places, to other activities, is actually quite crucial. So since we had that our building basically within St Martin's, I think patients can identify themselves by coming to City Reach, and that's their place, and that is the place where change happens for them. So I can't emphasize enough how important it is, apart from doing outreach, also helping people to find a place they feel comfortable in.
I'm just conscious of time and realise that we're probably not going to give any answers today, because I don't think there are any answers at the moment. It's about raising questions, and I suppose that's, we'll hand over to Duncan. But I think our final slide, it talks about the questions that are coming around the future, and the questions that we have at the moment are we seen as a primary care service, or are we seen as a specialist service, or both, and the implications that has on future commissioning. Looking at, should we be funded by the CCG, should we be funded by the National Commissioning Board, or public health, or a combination of those three, and that's just looking at health rather than looking at the health and social care models. Should we remain within an NHS trust? Should we be a GMS service, looking at models of CIC or private or third sector models? Will there be a service or will there be no service? And again, the final thing is looking at whether it should be joint or singular commissioning. And I think these are the questions that are important to us and probably important to Bevan. And that's sort of where we'd finish today about our presentation of where we are. And sorry, we don't have any answers about where things are going to be taken completely in the future.
Thank you very much, Kevin and Heidi. Let's leave that slide up, because I think that's got lots of the questions. Just a quick question, maybe of you, Kevin. In Bradford, they've got a contract to 2016. You talked about the interim period. How long is, what certainty have you got at the moment? Are you literally thinking you've got certainty for a year or two, or are we talking 6 months, or where do you think your current position?
We would like to think it's up to a year. I think we've been told that we are guaranteed we would be funded, but they can't guarantee who would fund that. So at the moment it's been hailed by the local CCG on an interim basis, so that's an ongoing thing. But we have been historically working on with the asylum team. We were looking at 1 month funding, 3 month funding, so 6 months to a year is quite stable funding in some senses.
We had recently quite close links to the CCG, because our lead nurse is part of a CCG group, and I myself have joined the CAT group for mental health, and that gave us that is quite important actually to represent your service within the local CCG or CAT teams, because that makes your voice and your service bigger and heard by other commissioners, so I think that's a good way of securing your funding, and I think for the next year we are pretty safe.
Thank you. So that's practical lesson one: influence and infiltrate the CCG,
and
volunteer for everything, and then quietly let them know you run a practice for homeless people and sex workers and refugees. Okay, we've got about 20 minutes just over for questions, so can we open up to the floor? We'll take them in ideally couple or groups of three, but we'll start with the lady at the back there. Thank you.
Okay. Helen Davis, currently doing some work with London Pathway. Just struck by your presentations and across the 2 days by how much it's provider-led, the response, which we've heard some inspiring examples of what's possible when people see a gap, get in there, meet the need. But what I'm wondering about is how and whether there's a need to build commissioners' capacity to understand what's needed, what good looks like, because, you know, what happens where we don't have inspired and inspiring local providers to do that local educating, really, of commissioners? And I'd just be very interested in your views from your experience of doing it locally, where else that could be scaled up.
That's a very good question. We'll take a gentleman over there. I think is he Jeremy? I think so.
It's Justin Varney, public health consultant in London. I suppose in response to Helen's thing, I was going to ask about whether in your local joint strategic needs assessments or health and wellbeing strategies, which are the pivotal documents, homelessness was mentioned at all.
Great. There's.
Do you want me to?
Let's take Andrew. Is it Andrew? Okay, let's take Andrew first.
Hi, yeah, Andrew Hayward from UCL. I was interested, both of you mentioned really about the QOF not being suitable. And I guess what sort of indicators you are using for judging your outcomes. And I guess also associated in that way is how we can start to build up a commissioning structure that is truly reflects the complexity of your patients and is able to document that complexity in a way that it can transfer into funds.
Excellent. Three very good questions. So we've got commissioners' capacity to understand themselves without having to be told, JSNAs, and what indicators should we have to best capture complexity of need? Three easy ones then. Do you want to kick off?
Do you want me to start?
Kick off, Les.
The idea of getting, I agree entirely with the sentiment behind the first question. It's always mystified me why I've been telling people about, I'd have thought that people whose job it is to commission services should be going out there and spotting gaps in, and identifying gaps in services for particularly the poorest and most deprived members of our community. But in fact, it's practitioners on the ground who, in fairly random, I mean, it was random, it wasn't, well, not entirely random, but it was a bit random that I ended up working in an area called Shipley, that I started to get interested in homeless people when I bumped into them working as a casualty officer in Leeds in 1982. And I ended up in a practice which allowed me to develop my own special interest. That's random, and yet, kind of as a result of, I don't want to talk myself up, but kind of as a result of my almost random approach to the shelter in Bradford, we end up with this with this sort of team and development. Is that you think about Pittsburgh, and if Dr. Withers hadn't been in Pittsburgh, where would the health of homeless people be in Pittsburgh? Why can't people whose job it is to commission services go out and sort this out? And we've had sometimes thinking about the way that our service has been managed. Sometimes we've had very sympathetic managers at PCT or PCG or health authority level who were very keen on the work that we were doing and wanted to explore ways of expanding our service. Other times we've had managers who frankly were less than interested and found us irritating. And when we asked for things like, we would like to have some stamps, we'd like to have money to buy stamps, they would say why. And when we wanted to replace a receptionist who'd left, leaving us with like one receptionist, they said no, there's a ban on replacing administrative staff at the moment in our organisation, so you can't have a new receptionist. We should probably let the other team respond a little bit on that question.
Why don't you do all three and then?
Oh
then
my goodness.
JSNAs.
Do you want to talk about? Let Gina talk about our key performance indicators.
And JSNAs as well. Are you in the Bradford JSNA?
Oh, I don't think they mention homelessness, but I managed to work out. They mention housing in the Joint Strategic Needs Assessment, and I managed to work out that we tick probably 70% of the boxes that you need to tick to get anything through the Joint Strategic Needs Assessment and the Health and Wellbeing Board strategy. So I think we're okay in terms of meeting their priorities.
Okay.
As for the coif, the question about the local coif and our KPIs that we had built into our contract, the quality outcomes framework that everybody works to nationally just didn't apply to us. Parts of it did, obviously, like asthma, diabetes, but the average age of our population is 32. So we don't actually do much chronic disease management in the traditional sense. Our chronic disease management is HIV and bloodborne viruses. We have a significant number of patients registered at the practice that are HIV positive, either sub-Saharan Africans or recently coming through our intravenous drug users from EU migrants. So that's a concern to us. So our QOF indicators are bloodborne viruses, homelessness, if you're living on the street, are you in a hostel? Are you in this revolving circle? How long have you been homeless? Language is really important to us because of our asylum seekers. Sexual health is huge for us. It's
it's one of our key indicators, along with mental health. 74% of our patients have mental health problems, whether they're homeless, whether they're asylum seekers, whether they're refugees, whether they've been tortured, whether the children that have been witnessed terrible tragedies, whether when the midwife said today about intravenous drug users or the working women, bereavement issues of losing the children. Mental health is one of the biggest ones for us. And going to sort of on a practical level, because I still, even though I have this managerial role, I still have two clinical sessions a week, is on our health needs assessment, the first question we ask is not, can we do your blood pressure or when did you have to have a smear, is where are you living? And wherever you are living, do you feel safe? That's the first thing that we always ask. And then we're off from there. The QAF has been successful for us.
Yeah, if I could just add, we've got five, what used to be called practice local QAF, but now key performance indicators. Five domains. I think it's language and registration, sexual health, mental health, homelessness, substance misuse. The main thing that we commit to doing is an annual full health check for people with any mental health problem. That's a very broad definition of mental health. Anyone who is homeless, anyone who has a substance misuse problem, and anyone who is on our register of either HIV or hepatitis C. That's the main thing that we commit to doing as part of our QAF. There are various other indicators which I could go through, but it'll take it would take too long to do that. And what happens currently, any national QAF domain in which we have less than 10 registered patients, the points from that domain, and points mean money, the points from those domains are transferred to our key performance indicator areas. So we are financially incentivized to achieve these things. I could go on about whether QAF is a good thing or a bad thing, and whether it's does it improve standards or does it deprofessionalize and the
calm
doctors
down,
and
no, but down.
I'll stop. But that's where we are. That's where we are at the moment.
You've made it work. Excuse me, Kevin and Heidi, on those three things.
I think drawing on Helen and Andrew's point together, and I think it's that building the relationship with the commissioners. I think what we've done, sitting down with public health and with the local CCGs, building into our service specification and our KPIs, is about having that, not clinical role, but actually attending conferences like this, and actually that educational role about reducing health inequality. So I think that's one of our important targets that we have. It's not the work with our actual patients coming through the door, but actually with the wider local community from a health perspective, social care perspective, and whether that's a local, regional or national level. So I think that's been a real key thing in our service specification, which we've drawn up quite recently. In regards to the JSNAs, I think we are highlighted in some of those, probably not as in detail as it could be, and I think that's something that could be worked upon, and that's something that we could bring out from this capacity we have now. So I think lots of the KPIs have been driven by how many people have come through the door, and it's that kind of, and actually it's acknowledging that perhaps we may not see as many people, or we need time not to see people to do these other things, like make sure that the needs are met in the JSNAs and service specifications which are drawn up. I don't know whether Heidi, you have any thoughts on the KPIs or?
To the first one, as I said before with commissioners, it is about making yourself public. So it's yourself and your patients. So for them to be visible and heard, because they're hiding somewhere on the streets and they are a nobody. And making them a person who has got a life story is quite important. So what we have is, I go regularly out to VTS talks and teach the young GP trainees and other doctors. We have got year five medical students in, and they have got their talks, and they meet up again our patients at A&E and treat them differently. And there's suddenly a more wider awareness of homeless people in Norwich, that they exist and they are real people and they need the service. And over the last 10 years, we have been an established service, and other GPs value our service hugely. So when it came in 2008 to a review, we had actually quite a bit of support from other local GPs who would say, we can't, in a normal GP surgery, provide the service City Reach provides. We would like City Reach to carry on, and we had supportive letters from local GPs saying this service is needed. So if you provide a good service, then your local community will support you. That's and if you are then in the CCG meetings and the CUT meetings, you can explain your needs and they will be heard. But people don't know unless you're telling them. In terms of outcome indicators, if they're good points, we follow them. If I've got a diabetic, we'll do the diabetic work up, although we don't get paid extra for it. But if it is in terms of care, we'll provide it. I'll do an epilepsy review, and we'll document that, but we are not getting paid for it. In the long term, for me, an achievement is if a patient comes every week or every other week. Engagement, if a patient comes to our service for the first time and we provide continuity of care for that patient who has never engaged for years with another surgery, that is for me an outcome measure, an achievement. If they value our service, and then from our base, they get taken to other places where they engage. Let's say the hepatitis clinic. We've got successful hepatitis treatment for several patients now linked in, and that hepatitis nurse comes to our service, to our place, and engages patients. That is a big achievement. We have got very close links with the local substance misuse clinic. They come in and people engage because they get seen at our place, which is City Reach, their place. So they've got an ownership of that place, and I think that's quite important. So trust and engagement within a logo, within a service. I am still looking for a good evidence-based. We have been looking at the STAR model. We have been looking at different questionnaires, how to measure it in a more visible way. We know we're doing a good job, but I think we do struggle at the moment finding the best tool to prove that.
I think the other issue we have six different groups of people coming to see us, and in some ways they're all marginalised from accessing mainstream services, or mainstream aren't meeting their needs, but actually their needs are very different. And actually sometimes you get performance measures which are pushed down upon you, which are putting everyone in the same group. And actually, each individual is different, but actually each one of those groups are very different. And the needs of an asylum seeker can be very different to the needs of one of the homeless guys turning up. And I think that's always a challenge that we have. But one thing we do know, if we don't provide evidence, whatever we do in the future, we're not going to get commissioned. So it's important to get that evidence and useful or outcome measures.
Okay, I'm just going to take one last round of questions. The three ladies have got their hands up, starting with the lady from Greenhouse.
Thank you. Oh, are we being televised? Yes. Oh, so I have to stand up. Okay. So I'm Angela Burnett. I'm a GP at the Greenhouse and also working in the voluntary sector at Freedom from Torture. So, a number of things. I mean, the issue about evidence, actually, we talked about in the workshop yesterday, really important. I think Andrew is coordinating us getting together in order to try and, you know, actually develop and share things and have that to actually go forward. I wanted just to say that at Greenhouse we are developing a social enterprise in conjunction with Healthy One. Similar problems to you, but we are dead impressed that your PCT managed to respond in 2 months to your expression of interest. Ours for 18 months responded really with their fingers in their ears and pretended, hoped that it would just go away. But I think the challenge is, I think definitely of saying this is a specialist service, because if we're compared to generic general practice, we're always going to look expensive, because of course we are. People have such complex problems, and I think we need to be saying that very loud and clear. And just a final thing with the commissioning. You're probably aware of the standards that London Pathways have developed, and they're outside, yeah? We're actually sort of developing, it's like a sort of library, we hope, for commissioners, because I think this is really important. We're just currently finalising a guidance for mental health commissioners about commissioning mental health services for vulnerable adult migrants. The leaflets are outside, and if anyone wants to sort of comment on the final draft, there's a last opportunity. I'd really value if anyone is interested. And there's also one for commissioning services for vulnerable women as well, which WEC produced.
Thank you. If you could just pass the microphone to Helen in front of you. There you go. Thanks.
Helen Matthey, I'm kind of wearing two hats, one from Homeless Link, but I'm also on secondment at the moment with the DH and have the task of trying to review a lot of the primary care commissioning models which are currently in use for homeless people and other transient populations. And I've spoken to Kevin and Les and lots of other practices over the last couple of weeks to try and get a sense of what's currently in place, what's effective about those, and how the transition to the new arrangements are affecting those. Within the next few weeks, I kind of will be coming up with recommendations to kind of feed into the DH and the Inclusion Health Programme. So I'm going to put a tough question to you, perhaps, but I mean, there's obviously a lot of kind of elements of provision that works, and what I've learned over the last few weeks or confirmed is how many different arrangements currently are in place, as you said earlier. So I'm kind of trying to look at, within the new system, how can we ensure the kind of local, you know, the elements of these services that have evolved over time can still be continued and can develop further in the new world of the NHS. So any top line thoughts on, from your perspective, what it is that we need to be kind of hammering home in order to protect and kind of allow services to develop. And the second point, very quickly, is entirely selfish. And as part of this review, I am trying to speak to other providers of primary care. So if you are within a service or work with a service, then please come and find me, because I'd like to talk to you. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. And lastly, this lady over here. Microphone's coming across.
I'm Gaynor Parry. I'm a mental health nurse. And I suppose I thought we were going to have conversations, and I didn't realise we were being televised, so I feel a bit dumb because I'm very new to homelessness, really. I've sort of worked in liaison psychiatry for many years and would see a lot of people coming through who were homeless. So I suppose the question that you've asked there in terms of looking at services and how we develop services, because I've been commissioned by PCT at the back of a fantastic commissioner who worked for housing, who felt at that time a pocket of money was there, harm reduction nurse, mental health were needed, and in we went. So my post should have ended in September, but they've sort of lost us a little bit, and we're sort of on the recurring register. But I know in April they're going to discover I'm there. You know, I've had to, again, it's keeping up stats and what I do. The hardest bit I've had to do is, well, proving your engagement and how important that is, because that's been the hardest bit for me. And also linking then into statutory services, which I'm finding, even though I sit within a community mental health team, that battle to actually get people to take on board and hear the need of these people and how complex they are. And in terms of education, I know we're all sitting here and we all know about the services and we're all passionate about it. How do we then go on to educate our peers about this service and about the need for these people? So that's a question, really, to try and move things on, really.
Great, thank you. Stomachs are rumbling, so ask the panel to come back for the final time. We had issues about evidence, peer education, And then sort of finally, if you could address yourselves to Helen's question, which is sort of a top line about how can we make things work in the new NHS. And if I could also ask you, what's your advice, which would be one bit of advice to other people who are running models or services to kind of help them kind of keep the faith in what they should do, you think, to help them navigate the new system. So what do we need the system to do? And what would be your kind of advice for those out in the system trying to make it work? Let's reverse the order. Kevin and Heidi, can you kick off?
If we're looking at the future of commissioning, I think health inclusion and the pathway are very key in that, and actually it's having that centralised body that are pulling things together. And I think it'd be really important and really useful to have some kind of national guidance, but also putting that in the context that our services develop the reason that they have because of local need, and actually each area is different, and actually what we need to provide in Norwich we know is very different to what would be provided in the rest of Norfolk, let alone the rest of the country. So I think it's important not to forget there is different local needs, but at the same time we need national guidance, although I'm not sure if that's called sitting on the fence. In regards to
questions about evidence. And peer education,
I think
your advice to providers?
The advice, I think, again, is making sure you're having regular and constructive contact with your local commissioners, and I think that's something that we've learned that's been very important. We are the experts in providing healthcare for marginalised groups within Norwich, and I think the commissioners have taken that on board and see us as the experts locally, and they don't have that knowledge and that expertise, but they are the commissioners, so it's actually building those relationships and maintaining those relationships and just working closely together, and whether that's with your current commissioners or future commissioners, but just a range of commissioners locally and making sure you are represented. We're very lucky we have Heidi here who's involved with the CCG. Tracy, who's our lead nurse, who's down here, is a member of the CCG, and it's just embedding your service within those sort of new commissioning pathways.
It is boring to go to those meetings, but it is worthwhile. So the other thing is reflect on your practice. And as we went along over the years, we kept reflecting on how we consult, on our prescribing, on how we treatment protocols. And that was hugely helpful in developing policies and how to deal with our patients, how to prioritize their needs, how to be really helpful and not just laxing. Sometimes you can lax in prescribing, find an easy way out. And sharing this with the wider doctors' community. So, for instance, I developed several protocols in prescribing how to handle our patients, and then presented them at local GP meetings or at VTS meetings. And people found that really interesting because there is a need in our wider community, in our doctors' community, in our GP community, to get more information about the patients we are seeing. And I think the recent discussions in the BMJ are helpful too, just to look at the medical needs at drug users and not making them just a social a group of people who choose to be awkward. And I think that needs a cultural change. We are lucky enough to be part of. And I must say, I don't find my job difficult at all. So, you know, it looks always like, oh, you're looking after homeless people. How honorable and what a hard job that must be. And I would always say, I can't see the problem, really. It is an honorable job, but I never go home as happy as after a City Reach GP surgery. We are a very happy team, and our patients give us so much good feedback that I never feel better after a City Reach homeless surgery. So I think if we get that message across, people love coming, for instance, all sorts of GP trainees love coming to be like in your service, you said that people really love to come to our surgery and watch what we are doing and learn from it. And it is an enrichment and not a burden. Yeah, and in terms of commissioning, I would say, I think we save the government loads of money because we have got lots of patients who spend year after year in prison and they now come just week after week to our service. And I think that's still cheaper than spending all their time in prison and on court.
Great stuff. Thank you. To wrap us up, Les and Gina, on those points about commissioning, evidence, what we need in the new NHS, and what will your message be to providers out there?
I'd just like to say my message to providers out there is don't take no for an answer. We've just kept pushing forward all the time. And act as an advocate as well for your patients and your service, and be supportive of, which we all are hopefully here, you know, of each other, and provide some aspiration for the patients as well, that their lives don't always have to be like this, that they can move forward and it can get better.
Right, well, right, the Angela mentioned the justifying the expense of your service, and we spent one of my colleagues wrote a chapter in our business plan called the Bevan model of care, and he tried to explain to our commissioners why we were more expensive and why perhaps we needed 15-minute consultations instead of the standard 10. And I'm not really sure that swung our business case. The thing that swung the business case for me was three graphs. And one, it was one table. And the person working to develop our business plan had the unit cost per patient of three different homeless health services. I can't actually remember which the other two were, but there was one that was much cheaper than us, one that was much dearer than us, and we were in the middle. And I think that actually swung the case with the PCT, that they felt there was some financial evidence that they weren't spending too much money and they weren't buying something that was cheap. And it was I actually feel it was a presentational thing rather than anything to do with the true cost or the true value of the service that we were providing. I'm sorry if that sounds a little bit cynical, but it does show the importance of presentation as well as content. As far as making sure that there is a decent standard of service for everyone throughout the country, and making sure that our own local services are maintained, I wonder whether instead of giving targets to services like ourselves or quality outcomes frameworks, we ought to give some targets to commissioners and say that in your area you need to show us evidence that you have commissioned services for the following vulnerable groups, and maybe list the vulnerable groups. We all know what they are: homeless people, sex workers, ex-offenders, drug users, etc., etc., and then say that unless you can prove evidence that you have services for the, give us clear evidence that you have services for these groups in your area and that these services are effective. And that would get, I think that would get that sorted out, and it would allow us to maintain the multiplicity of services that have all grown up in slightly different ways from the grassroots, which you don't want to scrap them to provide a sort of uniform service for the most ununiform groups of people that you could possibly imagine. But that would at least make sure that commissioners get a decent service in their area. And as far as peer education, I don't think we've answered that one yet. We've worked with GP trainees, trying to talk to them. We've been to our local medical committee to talk to the general GPs. We've worked with the CCG. We have medical students coming in. We have nurse trainees coming in. Pre-medical students come. We just keep an open door, I think, and try and bring as many people into our service as possible to show them what we're doing, and hopefully that spreads the word. And what my message is for other people, I don't know. It's just keep. Well, this was our motto: health, hope, humanity. I think that will do.
Keep on that winding
keep
road.
The faith.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your patience, everybody. Lunch is outside. We've had some excellent presentations from Les and Gina and Heidi and Kevin, and hopefully some practical things to take away. Please grab Helen afterwards. She's going to go and put some targets on some commissioners, but hopefully do some other things. I think we learned the importance of advocating, of making sure that you've got the evidence, you present it well with some good graphs, even if you've made up your expensive comparator and your cheaper comparator. Lastly, I think I'd like to go back to two of the things that Les and Gina said. First of all, the Bevan quote, which is about despite the financial times, we should be prioritising the health of the poorest and most vulnerable. And whilst we said we should infiltrate our CCGs, educate our peers and all the rest of it, if necessary, we might need to stay dissidents raging against the machine to make sure we get the healthcare for those who need it the most. So if we could thank our speakers and thank you for coming. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.